Michigan. Welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I was out last week, but it's nice to be back with my co-host, Rob Hunt, in San Diego, where I just was, and actually had the pleasure of visiting with Rob while I was down there and having a chance to catch up with him face-to-face for a change instead of just always seeing him in the fun in the sun. Rob, how are you?
I'm great, and Larry, that was a lot of fun. It was really nice to get a chance to see you and hang out and smoke a joint on the top of the hotel in San Diego, so that was a good way to spend a day, and great to catch up, meet your wife, meet some of your friends. So really, really enjoyable to see you and meet some other fellow Grateful Dead fans as you guys were sort of gallivanting around Southern California.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. We went on that night to see the last show on the Eddie Vedder tour, and we could talk about that for hours. I'm a big Eddie Vedder fan, and I've always liked Pearl Jam. This show was just absolutely amazing, and this little it was basically a community theater in El Cajon that looked like walking into either, you know, a really nice high school or maybe a community college type of auditorium, you know, with just one layer of seats, and Eddie was up on stage with all these guys, and man, they kicked ass all night. It was just, it was great, great music. And I have to give a shout out to my buddy Alex, who was with us on the trip and who had the musical karma and insight enough to be able to note that the show had previously been canceled and now was rescheduled for this night, which also happened to be the birthday of his wife, Andy Greenberg, another good friend of our show. And it was great to be with them and see great music. But today we've got something very, very interesting planned. And I think, Rob, it's fair to say that this is part of the creative synergy that came out of you and I sitting up on the rooftop there for a little while and talking about the state of the world and other things while we enjoyed certain products. And although it's not normally our place to do a lot of talking on this show about politics or things like that other than how they affect marijuana, in this instance, you know, given everything that's going on in the world, it's kind of hard to miss, you know, the significance of what's happening out there. So why don't you give everyone a brief little intro into our theme for today and how we got to it?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think for both you and I, it's a theme that, you know, means something on a personal level, simply because, you know, Morning Dew is a song that I think means so much to both of us. But from this, you know, from the perspective of why Morning Dew, you know, it's a song that obviously is very well associated with the Grateful Dead and has been since 1966. It's been one of the only songs in their catalog that was never put away or shelved. It was, you know, there from the beginning and it was there all the way to the end. You know, many, many people I know would say that Morning Dew is their all-time favorite song at a show. It's the one that you were, you know, desperately hoping for coming out of space, you know, to finish a show. But more importantly, from like a thematic perspective, it was written by a woman named Bonnie Dobson. And Bonnie Dobson, from what I understand, wrote the song after seeing the movie On the Beach, which is about, you know, the last survivors of basically full global annihilation after a nuclear holocaust. And the day that you and I were sitting up there, I think, was the day that Putin put the world on notice that he was putting his nuclear arsenal on high alert. You know, and as we discussed, there's no such thing as, you know, low alert for a nuclear arsenal. If you have one and you've got a button and you've got the nuclear football that rides around with the president or the president of any nuclear armed nation, then you know there's no such thing as low alert. But since pre-1989, I don't think there's ever a time that we've seen where we had to think about it, you know, like or to think about very much that there's anyone out there that's potentially crazy enough to even think that. Yeah, I'm sorry. Why don't you talk for a minute there?
Yeah, no problem. And I get it, Rob. This is, look, you know, the other thing we talked about, we're fathers, we're family men, we have friends, we have everything. And, you know, we find ourselves in a really, really tricky moment here. And it's very unfortunate that, you know, notwithstanding all the politics that, you know, people are playing with it you know, you can't escape from the fact that it is a real life moment for all of us. And, you know, we hope, as with any time one of these types of issues come up, the cooler heads will prevail. But one of the things that we've always been very good about it as human beings, I think, you know, is having the resources and the abilities to help ourselves kind of not just get through these times, but to actually comment on them and to try to take something out of them. And I think that that's what Bonnie Dobson did in this song when she wrote it originally. Is you know, I hate to talk about something being artistic when it relates to such a such a sensitive topic, but you know, she really took an artistic view, and she, but I think it was artistic in the sense of trying to say to the world, hey, this is what's happening, and let's not lose sight of the seriousness of this. You know, it's one thing to talk about a nuclear holocaust, it's another thing to, you know, to realize it and to see where it leaves us on the back end. And I think in that regard, the song was very, very important in terms of being written, in that it, by becoming a part of almost folk tunes in the way it was first written by her, in a style that's very, very different from the way the Dead and Jerry wound up performing it, it's almost as though she is issuing a warning to the world. And I think it was probably a message that resonated at that time in the early 1960s, when the folk movement was very, very strong and was filled with people who were leaders in the thought movement with respect to being pacifists and being community people and really wanting to see the world be a better place and staying away from war and kind of the mindless killing that goes along with it, and really understanding, hey, what can happen on the backside. And so I suppose in that regard, you know, I would like to think in part because of what the song represents, but almost surely also because of the type of tune that it was, a folk tune, a tune that, you know, really kind of resonated, is probably why Jerry originally went after it. And I think it's fair to say, with all due respect to Bonnie Dobson, who as the author and original performer of the tune always deserves all the credit for it, but Jerry really made it his own, and Jerry put a stamp on this song and an image on this song that it's just not possible to turn away from it. And it's a soulful performance that sends the message that Bonnie Dobson wanted to send and does send, but I think, you know, from kind of a different perspective, and instead of almost being the harsh awakening of a crazy landscape that Bonnie Dobson sings about, you know, Jerry sings about it in almost like a forlorn way, in an emotional way, that's saying, wow, you know, this is really something we probably don't want to find ourselves in the middle of. And, you know, we never want to get to a point where it says, where we have to look to each other and say, you know, it doesn't matter anyway. You know, we need to react, and we need to be proactive in all of these things prior to that. And, you know, I suppose in that regard, and again, still trying to avoid politics as much as possible, you know, for people to come out and praise Putin and to say that the man's a genius and the man is this and the man is that, when this is the guy who's going to push a button and potentially change the world, you know, is very problematic, because it takes...
Well, I don't think it is political anymore. I mean, I think what we're watching, unfortunately, like, look, you're right, there were certainly certain, you know, politicians and certain newscasters, or, you know, TV personalities, I should better categorize them as, that, you know, did come out in favor of Putin for a brief period of time. But I think in the last several days, watching what's happening, I don't think there's too many people left in this camp. And certainly on the world stage, you know, there's nobody left in this camp. I mean, this is the best isolation.
Well, Donald Trump.
Sure. You know, like, look, his CPAC speech certainly was, and Tucker Carlson certainly made some comments. I think he'll, you know, eventually regret that he ever made them. But from, you know, the standpoint of, you know, total isolation on the world stage, what's happening right now to Putin, as a result of his just unprovoked aggression into Ukraine, you know, look, I think he set out to change the global political, you know, create a global political shift, and I think he'll succeed. But I think he'll succeed in a very, very different way than he intended. And I think that, you know, as he thought, this is going to test the resolve of the West, and it's going to, you know, reclaim the glory of the former Soviet republic. I think what he's finding is, each day he gets further into this, the further on an island he's put himself, until he's, you know, now approaching, you know, the former Kim Jong-il status of North Korea, you know, for that regime prior to passing it on to his son. You know, like the sanctions that are going in, these are different than anything the United States has ever done. They're different than anything any other country has ever done. Putin may keep some, you know, some groups like the Belarusians or the Chechens that may remain on his side, but ultimately he's got a huge, huge portion of the world that are just rejecting his politics and rejecting his aggression. And if you watch what happened at the UN Security Council meeting yesterday, where all but three countries got up and walked out on Sergei Lavrov, you know, we've never seen that. We've never seen a time where, you know, the entire world it essentially says, like, we're not having it, where they close their airspace to him, where yachts now are getting seized, where airplanes are getting seized, not just from, you know, from Putin, but from every oligarch whose ill-gotten gains have been developed through, you know, the suppression of their people. You know, and I think it's not without some outside chance that, what's going to happen here, ultimately, will be that the revolution, you know, the Navalny revolution that, Putin has feared so much within his own country is now sparked internally, where it's not even about, you know, Ukraine resisting the aggression and, the world isolating Putin, but is this going to cause, you know, the Russian people to rise up and say enough is enough? I mean, so far 7,000 have been arrested already, and, those numbers are going up, you know, on a daily basis. Are we going to achieve what we've wanted as a world for a while? And, as I said, I started this off by saying I don't think it's political in so much as I think that there's very, very few people on the other side of the aisle that, I might sit on that disagree that, you know, this guy needs to be stopped. And at this point, it's clear.
Well, and you know what? I realize you guys will all be listening to this a few days after, but while we're sitting here taping it on Wednesday, March 2nd, last night was the State of the Union, and one of the things that really stood out to me was that on most of the statements that Biden made about the U.S. response to what was going on, he got applause from both sides of the aisle. And it was very heartening to see, you know, bipartisan support in that instance, and to know that, you know, even though many times we sit here and think, boy, how worse can this get for all of us, that there are still a few certain things where, at least as far as the world is concerned, you know, we stand united as a country, you know, and you know, notwithstanding the behavior of a few junior Republican members who are too junior to waste our time mentioning them by name, who, you know, thought it was time to, you know, turn to playground taunts. You know, the Republican Party leadership and even, you know, a lot of those who have been, you know, perceived by the left as difficult to work with. And, you know, that's what we want to see, and that's what we need to see, and let the world know that, you know, we may be a country that's divided on our own internal issues, but as far as the rest of the world is concerned, we're very strong, and we're going to send a message to people like Putin that, you know, proceed at your own risk, basically.
And I think that's not just us, but, you know, it's the 39 NATO countries. It's, you know, the rest of the Western world, countries that you never, ever expected to be involved in, getting, you know, putting their neck out on this, including Switzerland, who's been, you know, famously neutral now for their, you know, hundreds of years. Sweden and Finland, who, you know, never wanted to provoke Russia for fear of retaliation, are now supplying arms. You know, there's been rumors for days now that the Polish Air Force is going to supply, you know, MiG-29s to the Ukrainians. You know, Moldova, you know, using their country to shuttle, you know, goods and services and ammunition. And, you know, the U.S. as of today is, you know, the day that we're taping this, has now sent over Stinger missiles to make sure that there's, you know, better air defense against the Russians. You know, so short of, like, creating a no-fly zone right now in the Ukraine that would inevitably, you know, trigger a much, much larger confrontation, I think the Western world is doing everything it can to show, like, look, this isn't just about set one foot on NATO soil, but it's also, you know, we will do absolutely everything we can within our power without, you know, stepping over the line and creating this conflict into something much greater. But again, you know, we're not geopolitical experts out there. To anyone in our, you know, Larry and I are attorneys and weed guys and music lovers, and there's a lot of other things we claim to be, but you know, geopolitical scientists we are not. What we can tell you is, you know, I think, much like everyone out there in our audience, we're following this closely, and it just made it really, really appropriate to discuss, you know, as a theme of this show, Bonnie Dobson's words. So, you know, when we first started the show off, what you were listening to was from Freedom Hall in Kentucky on 6/18/74. It was an absolutely classic Do, and I think everyone out there's got their own favorite versions of Do.
But let me say this one thing about that, and I, because we are kind of doing it in this chronological order and really focusing on that, I'm not sure that there is another song in the Grateful Dead songbook, and maybe not too many other songs in all of rock and roll, that are so identifiable by playing one note. Jerry stands up there and plays that boom, boom, and before he even gets to it, everyone knows what it is. It's classic. It's amazing. And I think it's what part of builds the whole thing of the show. You're hoping, give me a do, and you hear that note. And at that moment, you're like, yes, here we go, man, buckle up.
Well, which is why I chose the Freedom Hall one, because that one has, you know, the quintessential bow before it goes in, ba-da-da, bow, bow, ba-da-na-na-na-na. And that first note, as you said, like as soon as you hear it, you know it's going down. And sometimes, you know, they wouldn't come into it as a standalone. They'd sort of trickle into it and play it out as something. But once in a while, you'd get one where it's just, you know, the same way that first note is Shakedown. You know, the second you hear it, you know it's a Shakedown. And that's the same thing with Do. And with Do, like, you know, I think there's like a collective exhale from the entire audience by about the sixth or seventh note of that song, where you've kind of gotten over, like, all right, here we go.
For sure. Yeah, it's great because not only are you enjoying it, but, you know, for anyone, and listen, if it's your first time hearing one, God bless, you know, who wouldn't want to go back and be able to relive their first live Do again, but, you know, enjoy that. But by the second Do, you know, you're like the rest of us where it's not only is it wonderful that they're playing the song, but, you know, you can spend the whole song anticipating what's still to come within the song. You know, it's just a great thing all the way around. And as we'll talk about more in a minute here, you know, entire Grateful Dead shows are classified or defined, you know, just by the mere fact that a Do is played. It can save a bad show all night long. They've been off. Jerry's been forgetting words. Bobby's, you know, doing whatever. Phil's out of tune. The drummers are not keeping beat. And all of a sudden, you hear that note for Morning Dew, and you're like, screw the rest of it, man. Now we're going to have some fun. And I can't really recall ever hearing Jerry go into a Morning Dew and not do well. I've never heard him forget the words in a Morning Dew. I've never heard him go in and stumble around with it. I think it's a very centering song for him. And when he's playing it, he's kind of in a zone, and the Deadheads feed off that energy that he brings to the table with it, both in the opening and, as you'll hear in a minute or two here, in other clips of other Dews we have from other venues. And you know, maybe why don't you go ahead and talk about what the next clip is going to be, and we can lead into that one, and you know, give people an idea of where the song goes once we get past the majestic opening.
Sure. Well, I mean, anyone knows the progression of the song knows that, you know, it sort of builds and builds and builds and builds. You know, really similar progression to, you know, maybe the way, like, I'm trying to think of other songs that do it. Scarlet, I guess, in some ways does it. But with Do, you know, it stays pretty mellow in the jams in between each verse, but it's not until, you know, there's, you know, two major jams, one that precedes the ending and, you know, one that's kind of in the middle, but either one could just, you know, set the world on fire. So the next one we're going to listen to, you know, for me, like, there's a handful of ones that everyone points to and says, you know, your repertoire of tapes or CDs or you know, now just streams isn't complete without them in the collection. It's from 1987 from MSG, which we've talked about the show before. To me, it's my favorite second set of the 1980s. It's the one that, not as a Morning Dew, but it's the one that went into the Good Lovin', La Bamba, Good Lovin', which is just, you know, the Watchtower before the Dew is just amazing as well. But this Dew, I think, you know, for the jam early on, is about as good as it gets. So let's cue that one up and listen to a bit of that. I guess it does, it matters.
If there's any doubt whether or not New York fans like a Good Morning Dew, that should dispel any notion on that. Yeah, Jerry comes out wailing. What I love about that is we talk about Jerry showing the emotion of it, and, you know, that's not always a place where the emotion comes in, you know, but you can hear it in his voice there. And of course, as you pointed out previously, once we were listening to the show and we were listening to the La Bamba, we were commenting as well on, you know, how you know, much emotion and energy Jerry was pouring into that La Bamba. So it was clearly a good night for him. I can certainly see and understand why you or anybody would, you know, be raving about that show, and it's one that I'm sorry I missed, but it's just great. And when, you know, you hear that, and you're like, boy, and now we've got the final jam, and, you know, that part that we're listening to right there, in my mind, that's them kind of, you know, beginning to lay the final foundation for the final build-up that we get, you know, to the big, you know, kind of climactic moment at the very end of the tune, which we'll here on the way out, and we'll talk about on the way out. But before we, you know, get to all of that, let's go back and it seems appropriate, you know, to maybe talk about some other dues that are out there, if for no other reason, because, you know, to try and say that we can capture the essence of a morning dew with three clips would be kind of silly, even for guys like us. And, you know, all you can do is find, you know, great moments here and there, but everyone's seen a dew that they consider to be their very best morning dew ever. And, you know, over the time, you know, the tune has taken on different formats. And, you know, one of the eras I think we have to look at certainly is the late 1960s, you know, particularly by 69 and the time that, you know, the Dead were working on Live Dead. And again, as we tape this today, this is the 53rd anniversary of the fourth and final night of the Dead's historic four-night run at the Fillmore West, which was released as a box set a number of years ago, often considered, you know, one of the best four-night runs of the Grateful Dead ever, just because they were at their peak in the psychedelic stage. And very, very many tunes from that show were eventually made their way over to Live Dead, which, of course, for many people remains kind of the pinnacle live album of the record era before we started taping things and all of that kind of stuff. And those shows were so important as well. But those morning dews were, you know, almost a little bit different because, you know, Jerry hadn't quite gotten on top of it yet. He didn't have that quite the same power drive that we see in some of these later versions. And it always strikes me that in some of those earlier versions, it almost sounds a little bit like the Bonnie Dobson version. Not quite getting there, but you can certainly hear it in there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, those early versions were much, much folkier and a lot less, you know, electric. They started getting, you know, towards the end, you know, the 66, 67 versions, you know, they started migrating to be, you know, kind of more psychedelic as well. But, you know, I think, you know, 68 was, I think, really where Dew came into its own. And by like 69 and 70, and 71, like I've always loved that Fillmore East 429-71 Dew is just one of my all-time favorites. Then, you know, the November 6th, I think, 1970, Porchester Capitol Theater is another one that from that era that just stands out. But there's so many, you know, sort of good ones that are really starting to show where the form of that song was going to take going forward. But, you know, starting, I think, in like 74, 75, is when you start getting the much more extended, you know, closings with a sound that I think we're more used to. It wasn't, you know, kind of that old Fender sound that he had in the 60s, and started progressing to a much different tone in the Dew. But, you know, I love looking back and, you know, as I said, it's one of the few songs that stayed in the catalog all the way through. So watching the progression and watching, you know, sort of how they interpreted the song until, you know, and many people I think would say like the 77, 78 was, you know, the crescendo of the Dew. But so I don't know, you know, Larry, like how someone, like after you started seeing the Dead, like I got to see it do my first show. Like how many shows did it take you before you actually got to do?
Let's see. It took me, I want to say it was my fourth show in Madison, Wisconsin. Although I would have to definitely go back and double check it. That would have been in 1983. And it was, you know, it was great. At that point, everything that they played was new and amazing to me. And it was, you know, all very wonderful. I would say that not the first Dew, but certainly one of the Dews that I heard that early on, or I guess, you know, in my Dead career was in the last night of the Dead did a four-night run, four shows and five nights at Alpine Valley in 1988. And just one amazing show after another. You know, for us, that was home base. So even though we had a schlep up to Wisconsin, leaving from the North Shore, it wasn't quite that bad. And we always had places to go and stay. And our good friend Deanie often let her parents' house be our home base with a fun swimming pool in the backyard and all that good kind of stuff. But that morning dew that night was just amazing. And as Jerry's playing it, everybody's completely focused on him. We were lucky to be inside the pavilion, and we were on Jerry's side of the stage, looking down on him. And he's in his little familiar, almost kind of hunched over thing where he's looking down at his guitar. And, you know, you're just amazed that this guy who doesn't move at all, that these amazing sounds are coming out of his guitar. And all of a sudden, we all noticed to our, what would have been to us to the right, but to Jerry to his left, up on the edge of the stage, and the stage at Alpine Valley kind of stretched out a little bit beyond where the performers stood, and then eventually kind of narrowed. some deadhead, some guy who was looked like your standard deadhead with a tie-dye shirt and the baggy jeans and the long hair all over the place, had made his way up onto the stage and taken three or four steps towards Jerry and then just stopped. And he was standing there watching Jerry in much the same way that the rest of us were, but he was up on the stage. And at one point we noticed Jerry briefly glance up over his glasses and look at him, and Jerry just kept on playing. And this guy just, you know, was like, he was in awe, we were in awe, we were in awe of the whole scene. And I don't remember if it was Steve Parrish or one of the guys who was definitely a Grateful Dead guy and not a local security guy or a local cop, walked over to this guy. They put their arm around his shoulder. They just kind of gently walked him off the stage. Jerry looked over for just a second to see, you know, what was going on, and then just dived right back in and, you know, thundered through the rest of the show with the crowd going wild that, you know, that this guy had, it was kind of like, you know, what every deadhead would like to do at that moment. You know, you want to be close to Jerry and feeling that energy, you know, zooming off of him while he's in the midst of an amazing doing. I'm sure if this guy was on hallucinogens or anything, the buzz was that much better. But to know that, you know, you're not going to get tackled and tossed aside like, you know, you might in some other types of shows by the security that would be there. And, you know, surely, you know, that's not the way the Hell's Angels would have necessarily handled the situation. But, you know, it was a perfect way to handle it. And the crowd, I think, was as appreciative of that as they were of the fact that, you know, it was just such a great morning dew. But that one stands out and is really hard to get away from. And you can find it on YouTube, and someday maybe they'll release some of those shows. But that was a do for the ages.
I think everyone remembers the dues that were really, you know, exceptional. And for me, I think there was, you know, a handful of them in the spring of 1992 that were fantastic. I think 3992 from the Cap Center in Landover, Maryland, where they ended the show and then played Satisfaction as an encore was pretty damn good. And then to close that tour, they played two nights, which you probably went to, Larry, at the Palace of Auburn Hills in late March, March 23rd, I think, 92. It was another amazing Watchtower into a do with the Glory encore. And those, like, 92, again, wasn't really known for, you know, the best shows, but that was, you know, there's definitely some spectacular highlights in morning dew. You know, probably the best ones I saw were during that tour.
1985, I was at the 20th anniversary shows at the Greek Theater. And the first night, second set, they came out and opened with a morning dew. And I had never seen that at all. And, you know, when you go back and you listen to some of the 68, 69, it wasn't all that rare. But for me, it was just amazing that an entire set would start off from a dew, because I always saw a dew as kind of like being the soft blanket that you land on at the end of the, you know, a crazy night of rocking and rolling to whatever they're doing. And they just kind of give you this to help bring you down, you know, so that you can be in a more reasonable frame of mind as you walk out the door. But it was great to see them open a second set with it. And the crowd loved it, and it created great energy. And another really good one is from a show that hopefully we'll be talking about in a couple of weeks here, one of my favorite shows and one of my favorite second sets of the 1980s, and that's from April 6, 1982 at the Philly Spectrum. And it's just an amazing second set. We won't talk about all of it now, other than to say that they come out of the drums into a Bobby Truck and into a Bobby Other One and then into a Jerry Do. And again, with one of those, you know, telltale first note drops, and the entire crowd just goes wild. And after such a great night of songs, you know, they're being treated to this morning too. And that's, I think, for a lot of people, and this will be a good bridge into our final clip, at least, that we won't necessarily listen to yet, but we'll set the table for. You know, when you talk about how a dew can really set the stage, a show that has nothing else going for it, a morning dew can make a difference. But this Philly show, for instance, was a solid show and would have been a solid show even if they had gone into Black Peter or Stella Blue. But the fact that they went into Morning Dew kind of elevated it up, you know, one step up the rung, that, you know, it was solid opener and solid all. And then, I mean, in everybody's perfect dead set list, you know, is there anybody out there who doesn't have Morning Dew as the, you know, the final Jerry ballad, you know, deep in the second set, post drums and space? And so when they pull it out, it really makes it wonderful. You know, we were just thrilled to see, as you're listening to that show, and boom, there it is. It's really, really good, and it's a great show, and I think we'll talk about that in a few weeks.
Well, and I think, you know, that's the other thing about the difference between going on tour and just seeing like one or two shows as one-offs. You know, if you did that, you caught a couple of nights, you were really hoping you'd get a due, but you know, you couldn't be guaranteed you'd get one. But if you're actually on tour and you're like, okay, you know, the first night of tour was a Wharf Rat, the next night was a Peter, the next night was a Standing on the Moon, the next night was a Stella, then you knew, like, each night you're like, okay, my chances of getting due are that much higher with each subsequent night, where you're just counting it down going, okay, you know, this is now the fifth or sixth night of tour and there hasn't been a due yet, that, like, you know, you're more excited for the next night knowing that the last three or four nights didn't have one, you know, and I can't think of another song where I could think of where, like, it, you know, for me, it was crossing songs off the list to say how much closer to due am I, and that's the way I always felt about it, and, you know, and the crazy part is, like, you know, thematically, like, you know, for like we've talked about this, that you and I think, you know, pay probably more attention to the music than we do to the lyrics of most songs. You know, like, for me, musically, it's a, like, that's why we're jam band guys, right? It's not, we don't focus on lyrics where we'd be indie guys, right? You know, or pop guys. But, you know, it's not to say that, like, the lyrics aren't, like, an exceptionally major part of the song. They are to me, but the story, I think, is always told through the music. And with Do, I mean, like, there's very few other songs where I can think of the Dead covered, like, a theme that was that serious, you know, and I think you had it with China Doll. I think, you know, Standing on the Moon certainly has it with, you know, War in general, but nothing as heavy as Do. And I don't know.
Even Throwing Stones, which was ostensibly kind of a political song, but none of those, you know, none of those foretell, you know, life after the destruction of civilization the way this one does. And I think that, you know, really makes it ring true for people in a certain way that, you know, it's like almost nice to hear the story, because if you're hearing the story, that means you're not living the story. And, you know, and Jerry can just come out and do it in a way that, you know, is special musically and is special and in every way he touches upon it. And one thing I do want to touch on, because we are going to, we'll let the cat out of the bag in our final clip in a few minutes after we take care of some other business, will eventually be from the Barton Hall show in 77, which, of course, this is the question that Rob and I were kicking around the other day. Barton Hall 77, great show, no question about it. It's considered, you know, maybe the greatest Dead show of all time. And now that I have it on CD and I can listen to it, I understand why people would say that. It's certainly an amazing show, but far and away, as good as everything else is in that show,
It's the Do
that stands out. And it's not even just the Do, it's the final 3 minutes of the Do, of which we're going to hear about the final minute and a half. And that's the sound, that's what everybody takes as they walk out of that place, was this amazing Do. And it almost makes me wonder sometimes if people don't go back and say, oh my God, that Do was, yes, it was the best show of all time, or was it the best Do of all time? Because it could have been the best Do of all time without being the best show of all time. I wasn't there, I can't judge it, you know, fairly enough, but... It's certainly, you know, one of the, if not the most famous morning dues that the Grateful Dead play, and as you'll hear in a few minutes, deservedly so.
But if you've been listening to the show, you know that since we started introducing a little bit of musical clips into the show, we usually try to keep them to like 25, 30 seconds, you know, just to illustrate kind of what was being played and how they were playing and what the sound was and who was doing what. You can't edit 30 seconds of that Barton Hall due. I mean, so there's absolutely no way we can provide 30 seconds, you know, without just going, there's no place to stop where it's just not, you know, completely and totally in the middle of the crescendo of a peak, you know, during that entire ending. So when I kept, like, trying to find different places to start it or stop it, you know, and technically I think, you know, you're not supposed to play other people's music for too long, but at a certain point, like, I don't think given, you know, where we are in the world right now, that there's any person in the Grateful Dead organization that would have an issue of us playing a longer portion of Morning Dew based on just kind of what's happening in the world.
No, I think you're right. And you know, it's important because even, you know, in these moments, and obviously, Rob, you know, these are very, like we said, you know, important issues, and they strike all of us very hard and in different ways. And yet, you know, while Morning Dew can remind you of that, you know, to hear the entire tune, but especially, you know, a beautiful ending, and especially a beautiful ending like Barton Hall, I think really kind of sends you on your way with a little bit of hope and, you know, a feeling that, you know, the warning is, you know, as deep and dire as the warning might be, it's just a warning. And, you know, we're out there trying to, you know, keep the world together and in one place, and hopefully people would do it. And who knows, maybe if we could get it translated into Russian and send it over to Putin and he listened to it, it might make a difference. You never know.
Yeah, I mean, look, and that's the thing. I mean, for me, like, when you think about the lyrics of songs, like, even though thematically they're very similar, Standing on the Moon to me is a song of hope. That's a song with like, you know, like, hey, everything's fucked up, but, you know, it's fixable. Due to me is not. Due to me is resignation. It's, you know, like we're past that. We blew it.
Right. By the time we get into Morning Dew, right. By the time you get into the what's happening with Morning Dew, we're long past that situation. There's no question about it. But again, you know, anytime we tell a story of woe and despair, you know, I think it's human nature, you know, to try to find a way to put some sort.
Right. Well, the art is the warning. You know, the that's the beauty of it is you know, it's being written before you have to say that there's resignation, and it's, you know, it's preventative. It's a prophylactic to you know what could happen, but you know, once in a while you remember there's assholes out there that don't look at it that way. To them, it's, you know, like the world isn't something that is shared. It's something that they believe is theirs.
Right, or certainly that they are, for whatever reason, that of all the human beings that have ever walked this planet, that somehow they've been the ones anointed to think that if they want to push a button and end civilization, you know, they not only have a right to do so, but maybe that they were destined to do so. You know, and that's certainly been our concerns with all the various, you know, Kim family members in Korea, for, North Korea, for quite some time. But, you know, I think that was always tempered by the fact that we've never been given any reason to truly believe that they have the technology to pose a viable threat, or at least a threat that, you know, will be keeping us up at night. Whereas Russia, you know, we've all learned from the day we were born, unfortunately for our generation, you know, that they are out there and that they're a reality. And, I mean, in fact, I was born within a few weeks of the Bay of Pigs, you know, and who knows, things go a little bit differently one way or the other there, and maybe I'm not. So, you know, you can't escape those moments and take them for granted, but by the same time, I think, and one of the things I always loved about Jerry was kind of that he tried to put a positive spin on things, you know, when he sings Dear Mr. Fantasy, instead of, you know, sing us a song to take us out of this gloom, he always sing us a song to keep us out of this gloom. You know, he's already on the positive side of it. You know, we're not living in gloomy times, man. We're talking about it maybe, but we're on the positive side, and that's where we want to stand. That's where we want to be.
And that's a great point.
And I always loved hearing that. And I think the same thing here, that, you know, the emotional ending that he gives us allows the Deadheads and everybody for a minute to, you know, to kind of let go of the deeper message of the song and just kind of revel in the, you know, the moment that Jerry creates for us and take something positive out of there as we walk out the door.
Yeah. And then look, I want to make sure that we're clear that I don't think either you or me believes that, you know, nuclear holocaust is happening anytime soon, despite the fact that they're saber rattling. And it bothers me to no end that some asshole out there thinks it's okay to even consider threatening, right? In any way.
Right. Well, look, our generation, relatively speaking, has been very lucky in that we have not, you know, had to sit and face down very many situations where, you know, there was a real, you know, credible threat of somebody being crazy enough to use nuclear weapons. But, you know, certainly Vladimir Putin and the mere fact that he's undertaken this campaign and all of the nonsense that he spews out to try to justify everything that he's doing, you know, all of a sudden has to make anyone stop and think for a moment, at least, you know, whether this man is in fact capable of taking that next step. And, you know, we listed all the things that all the countries in the world are doing to help. And, you know, for some of those countries, Putin has already issued a warning that, you know, if you do that, you can expect our response to, you know, possibly even be nuclear level. And I think a lot of these countries are, you know, calling his bluff on that to some degree, at least. And while I hope it doesn't get into a dangerous situation or anything like that, you know, where it becomes credible, you know, it's nice to know that people are basically saying to him, look, we're not going to let you hold us hostage. We're not going to just sit by and let this be business as usual. And, you know, we live in a world now that for better or for worse, and maybe in this case for better, is so interconnected that, you know, as you and I were talking about, Rob, it's possible to hear directly from the people on the ground and you know, to avoid altogether the propaganda machines that are trying to feed us whatever story they want us to believe.
And by the way, the noise that you guys just all heard on the podcast right now that piped in for a second, I apologize for, was me actually trying to pull something up that I was going to share with the audience, which is, you know, there are some mediums out there that aren't, you know, your traditional news organizations. You know, they're instead people that are on the ground that are trying to get the word out of what's happening in Ukraine directly. And, you know, one that I'd point to that I've just found to be an exceptional resource is on Clubhouse. And the room is called The Big Picture. And that room has now been opened for 6 straight days without a single second of closing the room down. It's averaged over 1,000 people at a time in that room. Over 250,000 people have tuned into that room. And the entire goal of that room is onefold, and that's to provide accurate information of what's happening. It has to be verified information. If it's conjecture, if it's, you know, like not confirmed by multiple news sources that are reliable, they don't talk about it. Someone else tries to bring it up, they'll shut it down and say, sorry, that's unconfirmed. We don't have confirmation on that yet. But it's curated by, you know, 20 different, you know, tech professionals and other people that work either in the UN or work in other government agencies. But they've just gotten together and decided, you know, hey, this needs to be done. Someone needs to do it. And they're calling not just from U.S. media, not just from British media, but, you know, directly from media sources all over Eastern Europe. And in fact, there's plenty of people from the Ukraine, or pardon me, from Ukraine, that are continuing to go into that room and saying, hey, I'm in Kyiv right now, or I'm in, you know, Kharkiv right now. And this is what's happening. This is what we're seeing real time. And on top of that, they're also providing information on, you know, if you want to get involved and you want to donate, here are the organizations that can do it. You know, we don't talk about it too much, but guys like Jose Andres, who is, you know, just done exceptional work in feeding people that are in, you know, war zones or after, you know, major tragedies. There's a ton of different ways that people out there can get involved outside of just saying, like, go, you know, go U.S., sanction the hell out of these guys. But if you actually want to be directly involved, like, there's 5 or 6 million refugees that are now leaving Ukraine for Poland and for other parts of the of Western Europe that, you know, need to get fed. There's, you know, we talk about the war and the damage of war right now. You know, we're 6 days into it. It's going to get a hell of a lot worse. And the humanitarian crisis and the disruption of the food supply and the disruption of the water supply and the disruption of everything else that's about to happen to these major cities, it is going to be catastrophic.
Yeah, I agree. Something's got to be done. There's no question about it.
So find the thing you want to support. You know, find it and figure out a way to start, you know, donating. Find a way to donate your time. If nothing else, find a way to listen to what's happening on the ground so you can truly educate yourself and not just hear what CNN wants you to see or what Fox wants you to see. You know, it's great. They've got some human interest stories here and there, and they, you know, focus on one family and a little girl who's hugging her mother as, you know, the father gets on the train. I get it. Those stories, you know, they touch you emotionally. But hearing the real voices of the real people in real time as they're actually explaining to you what it's like to be in a bomb shelter in Kyiv.
Pretty powerful stuff. And, you know, until you've actually listened to it, you know, you can't really imagine it. And, you know, I appreciate you sharing that with us too, Rob, because, you know, it's important for those of us that haven't made that connection on Clubhouse yet and understood what some of those resources are that are available to us in this very, you know, hyperlinked and connected world. You know, and it's, I mean, the stories that have been coming out about the way people have used the internet, both for purposes of communication as well as for purposes of disrupting the Russian logistics efforts has been nothing short of amazing. And I think that, you know, when all is said and done and people have the time to go back and really revisit and write about what happened during these times, we're going to find about a lot of people who, you know, through their bravery and courage to keep the rest of the world informed and up to date, you know, helped avoid a situation where somebody like Putin could shape the argument and the dispute however he wanted because the other voices just couldn't be heard. So certainly to people who are interested in it, please tune in.
Yeah, and I'll say that as powerful a medium as like Facebook is or Instagram or Twitter is, nothing, like literally when it comes to this kind of content, nothing is more powerful than the human voice.
True. And it's the human voice, whether the human voice is talking, whether the human voice is singing, which, you know, again, inevitably takes us back to Jerry. And, you know, the ability to do what he does in such a profound way. And, you know, many a night have I walked out of a show after a do like that with tears in my eyes, and I've seen the people next to me and all over the place. It's hard not to, because you do kind of get that raw mixture of doom and dread, of emotion, of, you know, beautiful soulful music, as well as for most of us, except the night when it opened the show, that, oh my God, this means the show is almost over if they're into morning dew now. But nevertheless, it was always great. And, you know, we all had our morning dew t-shirts that were the takeoff on Mountain Dew and all that kind of stuff. And it was mandatory to have it. And the game was always to try to wear it the night when they played a dew. And, you know, of course, the way the dead world works is any night you're expecting to hear a song, you're usually not going to hear it. And you have to go in thinking, forget about it, or not even thinking about it. And then all of a sudden, lo and behold, there it is.
Yeah. I mean, you and I had some great, some cannabis news to discuss. But honestly, I think after the show we've just done, I don't think it's, you know, necessarily all that appropriate. Yeah, I think we can, table it.
No, and you know what? Look, it's cannabis news, and while cannabis news is great to talk about, in terms of what's happening on the world stage, it really kind of loses its importance right now, except, I will say, for its ability to provide those who use it with perhaps a slightly more calming and relaxed attitude as we try and sit here and assess what's going on with the world and still be able to function and sleep and do all of those kind of things. Certainly, to be in a state where it's legal to come, having just been out in California for a week where it's more than legal, it's kind of like the tap water almost.
You smoke weed on rooftops.
Beautiful. Well, like I told you that moment, people can laugh at this, they can say whatever they want, but there is something that's much different about smoking weed outdoors in California, especially there up on the top of a peak after a wonderful 45-minute climb with good friends or wherever it might be. That just, kind of takes you to a different level. It's like those moments you feel that this is what, marijuana maybe was made for, to really take these moments and help enhance them. And although I'll always be happy to smoke it anywhere, there's not quite the same feel doing it in Skokie, Illinois, as there is doing it on a rooftop in San Diego, watching the ocean roll in and the sun set. And for those of you who haven't done that lately, let me suggest that that is something that is well worth doing. And it does help you get away for a week and relax and unwind. So I think that we've addressed this issue for enough today. People will have plenty of stuff to go and think about. Hopefully they will think about it in a positive way and think for ways that we can all as a society better ourselves and better the world and, show guys like Putin that we don't really care about him and that he can't take over just because he looks good on a horse with no shirt. So, we'll see where we go with that. We've got some great shows coming up in the future. We are going to talk about this dead show from Philly in early April. We have some very, very interesting guests. One or two of them from inside the dead family again. We're not going to drop names yet until we know exactly when and how we're going to have these people on. But please stay tuned to the Deadhead Cannabis Show future episodes, and we will not disappoint in that regard. Rob, I got to tell you, thank you for suggesting this topic today. It's a little bit different from us to focus on one song as opposed to a particular show, but I think that it was both timely and there's probably very few songs in the Dead's repertoire that have the same meaning and impact that Morning Dew does, and makes it a very, very appropriate topic for this type of format.
Yeah, thanks. A bit more emotional than I expected.
That's what nuclear war will do to you, unfortunately. And Jerry Garcia can do it to you on a beautiful night as well. So having said all of that, and as we head out here, I'm going to say my goodbyes and I'm going to turn the show over to Rob so he can introduce the closing moments of perhaps the greatest Morning Dew of all time from what many people consider perhaps the greatest Grateful Dead show of all time. To everyone, this is Larry Mishkin. Thank you so much for listening. I look forward to talking to you all next week. Enjoy your marijuana and cannabis responsibly. Rob, it's all you.
Thank you. And we're going to close this with a nice big clip from 5877 Barton Hall in Ithaca, New York, on the campus of Cornell University. It is the legend, the show that everybody's always had, one that, very rarely you listen to anymore because we've all listened to it so many times. But this Dew is the Dew to end all Dews. And with that, I'm Rob Hunt, and I stand with Ukraine.